Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you
fire.
In November of 2018, the most devastating wildfire in California history completely obliterated a 27,000 population town called Paradise. Today, reporters who write for The Guardian newspaper based in Britain, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, join me to talk about their new book, Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. November 8th, 2018, the town of Paradise in Northeast California was virtually destroyed by a wildfire that originated on a PG&E high-tension tower. In a new book called Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy, two reporters for the London-based Guardian newspaper have put together an account of the events in Paradise in Butte County. In this new book, which I've been reading over the past week, they did an excellent job of not only describing the narrative of the tragic events of the day, but also introducing us to many of the victims and many of the survivors, many of the heroic responders who tried to fight this devastating firestorm. And I'm joined today by Alistair G. He is a writer and editor for The Guardian. He's also written for The New Yorker and The New York Times and The Economist. Alistair, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And his co-author is Danny Anguiano, who writes for The Guardian as well. And she previously wrote for the Chico Enterprise Record and lived just about 20 minutes south of Paradise. Danny, thank you, too, for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So, Danny, I can understand you were assigned to cover this fire for The Guardian within 24 hours of the news breaking. But did you actually know any of the people in Paradise who are mentioned in the book?
I did. So, you know, as you mentioned, I lived about 20 miles down the road from Paradise. And in that part of Northern California, it's quite rural. And you don't have these big cities that really flow out into suburbs. It's kind of these distinct little towns. So I lived in Chico. I'd lived there for 10 years. I had a lot of family and friends in the area. So, you know, my cousin and uncle lived in Paradise. My brother-in-law was an officer on the police force there. So I knew some of the people we talked to before this, both from the personal connection I have to the area and as well as the years I spent as a reporter there. So it was very much a story that felt personal and urgent to me.
Now, doesn't that make it more difficult as a reporter? Detachment is a great asset. And while, you know, knowing some of these people, knowing part in, you know, really reporting this story, you had some advantages, it also brings an emotional price for you as the observer who's capturing this.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. As you mentioned, I had some advantages. I knew where to go, where to look. I knew, you know, the authorities in the area who are making these announcements. But I think when you have an event of this magnitude, this massive fire that basically destroyed this town within a day, what happens is you have people from all over the country and, you know, in some cases the world coming to cover it. And I knew that's what was happening. And I knew that because I had this special connection to the area and this intimate knowledge that I could tell this story right and, you know, depict the town as it was from the perspective of someone who knew it. And that was really important to me when the eyes of the world were going to be on Paradise.
And working with a reporting partner like Danny, who has these connections and history in the area, certainly had to be an advantage for you. At the same time, did you experience an emotional response, a form of PTSD, to dealing with this incredible tragedy and the losses that were caused?
Well, firstly, Danny, it was invaluable to be working with Danny. She just understands the area better than anyone, probably any other reporter I could have worked with. So it was essential. And of course, you're deeply affected by what happened. I remember the first time I drove through Paradise a couple of weeks after the fire, and the town was still cordoned off. They were searching for human remains, and so they weren't allowing people in. And Paradise was essentially wiped off the map. It's such a fate that's really unprecedented in the modern era in the U.S., where an entire town was burned to the ground. Over 90% of the buildings were burned down, 14,000 homes. So it was a town that was marked as much by the road outlines. That was how you could tell where the town had been. It was simply gone. There were, in many cases, there was simply rubble. And so it's a terribly upsetting sight to see. And then you add into the mix the fact that the 30,000 or so residents of Paradise and many more in the surrounding towns, they were displaced around Northern California. And so you have not only this crisis of destruction, but you also had a refugee crisis. And meeting with those people, they are some of the hardest interviews I've ever had to do.
Mm-hmm. And so as we look at this picture, California, due to climate change, we had a very serious drought. There was a peak estimate of 160 million dead trees mostly in the forest lands of California. And the combination of what are called Diablo or Santa Ana winds, depending on which part of the state you're in, during the peak fire season in the fall, create these conditions. And you referenced the Oakland Hills fire of the 1990s, and then really annually over the past 4 years, we have had devastating wildfires. And we'll get to the role of the what I call the rogue utility, PG&E, shortly. But just the conditions of this area made it extremely vulnerable to whatever source of spark could have this conflagration. And it raises serious questions about what the experts call the WUI, the wildlife-urban interface, and or wilderness, maybe it's wilderness-urban interface. And to your credit, I didn't see you use WUI once in the book. but I do think that, you know, as we zoom out and look at the condition of the planet and then just look at the condition of some areas of California, we live with an incredible level of risk. Danny, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I don't think we use the words WUI in the book. That's certainly something that was on our minds as we were telling this story, given, you know, the location of Paradise, this development nestled in the Sierra Nevada foothills. It was very much a part of, you know, what we call the WUI. And it's certainly everything that happened there has raised really important questions. You know, people ask, should people be living in these areas of, you know, on one hand, so California, to have these developments, you know, among nature and wilderness. But there is a certain risk with that. And I think what Alistair and I found from, you know, all these interviews we did and from the time we spent in the area is that a lot of the people who lived in Paradise and on the Ridge, communities like Magalia and Concow, they lived there because they loved it, because it was beautiful, because it was nestled among millions of trees. But at the same time, many people lived there because they could afford it. It was a town where retirees could go and know that their retirement would last them there, and where young families could afford to buy a home. And so I think for us, we've just seen that that's kind of an element that's been missing from the conversation, that, you know, we ask, should people live there? But we kind of want to ask, you know, where else will people live? This is where people are going to live, where they can afford to live and to build. And so I think the question for us is more, how do we get people to live there safely? Are there things we can do to reduce their risk in living in these areas?
Well, and Alistair, I'll ask you about this, because I'll concede to a certain smugness from the comfort of California. When I see repeated destruction from tornadoes in certain that are easy to kind of look down my nose at, and I say, well, why do those people keep rebuilding in the same damn location where, you know, a twister came through and killed their family, destroyed their home? And why do they expect it's not going to happen again? But in Paradise, in Coffee Park, the section of Santa Rosa that was virtually burned to the ground the year before, we see people just holding on to those properties and saying, damn it, this is mine, and I'm going to rebuild despite the risk of a likely repeat event.
It's interesting. As natural disasters go, wildfire might be one of the only ones that we think we have some control over. When a twister comes, when a hurricane comes, we don't think, oh, we can divert that, we can ameliorate it. We just get out of its way and we try to harden homes to resist it. With wildfire, we have historically been somewhat successful at containing it. We have this incredible state wildfire firefighting force, CAL FIRE, that's able to put out many thousands of fires and able to avert destruction, loss of life. And in some ways, you think wildfire is under our control. And I think what firefighters were telling us, and that climate change scientists tell us, is that sure, to an extent, but maybe we need to relate to it more as a hurricane. It's something that's going to be, it's part of California's landscape. The environment here has evolved to adapt with fire. The trees can withstand fire to some extent. And so perhaps rather than thinking, I'm going to build that here and we'll just be able to keep fire away somehow or divert it around us, we need to think how to live with fire. And I think to the credit of many, probably, you know, the vast majority of people in Paradise, they knew this. They knew that they were living in a fire-prone area. They were by no means oblivious. I think of one woman we met, her name is Iris, that lived in Paradise and the surrounding area for a long time. She worked in Santa Rosa, yeah, near the Coffee Park area that you mentioned. And people there, like Iris, knew that fire was just a part of Northern California life, and they knew that Paradise was destined for a fire. I think what was different in this case was they didn't think that a fire this bad would come through. And what the fires that we're seeing now, what fire scientists call mega fires, are really a different kind of beast. And we haven't really planned for these kinds of fires.
Well, and in the book, you have rich descriptions of the effort to evacuate, and to the credit of city leaders, there was a plan. They had anticipated some of the risk. Nobody ever imagined that they would have to evacuate the whole town at the same time. But as I look up and down California, we have so many communities with narrow roads, with only a single route off of a mountainside or a hilly area. And, you know, we're working to manage the vegetation and, preserve a protective zone around structures. But fundamentally, we're screwed. And we, you know, we are not willing to spend the money to underground the power lines that are a serious risk of starting these fires. We're not willing to use eminent domain to create escape routes in areas that, like I just described, where there's only one way out. And so we seem to live in a state of denial in too many respects.
I think, you know, when disasters the magnitude of what happened in Paradise occur, it really kind of shocks the senses, and it makes us realize that actually the worst case scenario is possible. And I think that's been, you know, one of the positive things that has come from this is that towns suddenly realized, wait, this could happen to us too, and, you know, are looking at how they make changes. I mean, Paradise did so much to prepare for a big fire between having, you know, these set evacuation routes and having performed evacuation drills and dividing the town into zones and doing road projects so that there would be more routes out. But what we saw is it just wasn't enough, and that, you know, the rest of the state really can't expect that won't happen, that they need to put in the same level of preparation, if, you know, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me next move to, again, what I call the rogue utility, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And if I have a criticism of your book, I think you went a little too easy on PG&E. And historically, and if you'll indulge me for a moment, I want to take listeners all the way back to the 1980s, when PG&E bungled the construction of the Diablo Canyon Twin Reactor Nuclear Power Facility. And the cost overruns, they had to bring in a whole separate contractor, Bechtel, to correct serious errors in the cooling system. And so it was about a $3.5 billion cost overrun. And PG&E spent the next 20 years to jam their losses onto the ratepayers. And they were blocked by the Public Utilities Commission and the courts. And so their lobbyists wrote their own deregulation bill that sailed through the legislature in Sacramento in 1999. And it led to the bankruptcy, the first bankruptcy, which occurred when Enron and El Paso Natural Gas gamed the system, again, that PG&E had created for itself. We had these rolling blackouts. The state lost somewhere north of $10 billion, where the state was buying power from other parts of the country that PG&E couldn't pay for. This history is important because you do correctly pick up with the San Bruno conflagration, which was caused by PG&E gas pipelines. And we discovered at that time that PG&E didn't even know where many of its gas pipelines are located, and that they had gone cheap on pipeline inspection, where they would, you know, use these devices called smart pigs, but not every gas line could use those inspectors, those robotic inspectors. And so that history informs the failure to properly keep trees trimmed, and the gross negligence of having power facilities that are 99 years old in a fire-prone area like Butte County. And so, for me, you cannot be tough enough on PG&E. I feel that you did, I think, you know, a good job of describing the more recent events, but the sordid history of this company, I think, needs to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's certainly one of the things that we talked about at length, is how do we tell this story that is so intertwined with PG&E's failures and negligence, without just writing a book about PG&E. And so I think we had to make, you know, some challenging choices about where to jump into the story and what to include. But I think, you know, ultimately what is clear, what we hope we made clear and what has become clear to much of California and the rest of the country, was that PG&E's equipment started this fire because they failed to maintain their equipment because they didn't have the proper knowledge about its age or its maintenance, and that was avoidable. That certainly could have been avoided and perhaps spared the town of Paradise so much destruction and devastation.
Well, and Alistair, there's a big component of greed as well, because, you know, I talked a little bit about the failure to have proper mapping and control of the condition of their gas pipelines. But PG&E historically gave bonuses to executives who cut the budget for tree trimming. And that, you know, that history shows me that they value profits and dividends for their shareholders over the safety that they're always talking about.
That's the paradox of an investor-owned utility, that on the one hand, they are committed to providing a profitable return to their shareholders, and on the other hand, they are supposedly committed to investing everything they can to ensuring the safety of the people they serve. And for many people, that's an irreconcilable contradiction. How can you have a company that is guaranteed to invest everything in safety and at the same time deliver a profit? How do we know that the money that's going to profit shouldn't have been invested in power line maintenance, for instance? And that's informing a lot of the conversations that are going on right now. Should the state take over PG&E? Should the company be broken up in some way? I think of, for instance, the San Bruno pipeline disaster that you mentioned. As you said, it came out that they didn't really have proper maps of what was underground, didn't know the connections had been welded onto these pipelines to weld them together. With the power line in question that started the Paradise fire, it emerged, as you said, that these power lines were so old, in fact, that they had been considered for inclusion on the National Registry of Historic Places. And there was certainly, as we've seen, as becomes clear with the recent report from Butte County, that PG&E continually cut back on the kinds of investigations and routine maintenance that was required for these pipelines. And at the same time, they say that they don't have enough manpower to ensure that trees are trimmed enough around these power lines. And so it does seem as though PG&E is, well, how do you fix a problem like PG&E? That's the central problem, I think, that California faces with regard to power at the moment.
Well, and they went in to face the judge. They're on criminal probation in one courtroom, and they just exited bankruptcy in a separate court proceeding with a different judge. And they're saying, well, you know, we'd have to hire every tree trimmer in the country, and it would cost, what, $600 billion to do this. Well, that's an unacceptable load of bullshit, because, you know, this is their job, to maintain their facilities and to keep them free from the fire hazard of trees that grow up next to a high tension line. And for them to spin out this, you know, impossible mission and therefore say, well, why should we even bother? it's really insulting and a very dangerous mindset.
Yeah, I think it really taps in, what you're saying really taps into what we've heard from a lot of the victims of the fire and the survivors of the fire. Their task, their job as a company is to provide power to Californians to service their customers, and they should be able to do it without killing anyone. And, you know, one of the women I talked to whose father died in the fire, she was so upset when she heard some of the things that PG&E's lawyers were arguing in court. She said, my dad never missed a bill. He always paid his bill on time and, you know, wasn't afforded mutual respect by PG&E.
Well, and just to underscore that, Danny, when you pay your bill, part of it is allocated to a tree trimming account. The ratepayers pay for that. And
exactly.
And then PG&E pockets the money and rolls the dice. You know, hey, you know, there's a good chance calamity won't happen this time, this fiscal year. And, you know, we've all the heads have rolled. They brought in this guy, Bill Johnson, from the Tennessee Valley Authority, who had a safety agenda. and he turned off the power in areas that were not at great risk for a wildfire. And the Kincaid fire last year started just a mile north of the end of the shutoff zone. They keep changing the management, but it doesn't appear to change the culture, Alistair.
Yeah, PG&E's culture is, it's also, it's worthy of its own book. In various reports by federal agencies like the NTSB, they have cited precisely what they call a dysfunctional culture within PG&E. And we spoke to a former judge from the regulator, from the PUC, and he said that he puts PG&E into this category of companies or organizations where it's so complex that no one person could possibly understand it. It's just this sprawling. They have over 100,000 miles of power lines. And this former regulator judge says that it's almost literally impossible to get your head around how complex this system is. I think it's worth considering as well what PG&E says in its defense. And in some ways, it says some things that we would agree with. PG&E says that in an age, in an era of climate change, that it's impossible to stop certain kinds of fires or some number of fires breaking out. And I think while accepting that PG&E bears a great deal of blame for what happened, we also do need mentions of the California wilderness, which has been several of the hottest years on record in recent decades. In the summer prior to the fire in Paradise, we saw this terrible fire tornado in Redding. We saw extremely hot conditions, very dry conditions. And we also look at the history of forest management as well. It's no surprise to us in California. We know that we're so successful at putting out fires. Cal Fire has done such a good job that actually forests are thicker than they historically were in the time of John Muir, in the time when Europeans arrived in California in the 19th century. And so there are all these factors swirling together, PG&E, the forest, climate change, people living in the Wui, as you said earlier, that just added up to this terrible catastrophe in Paradise.
Mm-hmm. Well, you referenced a judge from the Public Utilities Commission. That is a paper tiger. And one of the big negative legacies of Jerry Brown was he left Mike Peavy in as the chair of the PUC, a guy who was a former utility executive from Southern California Edison. And he was not the first of the industry figures who took the revolving door into being a lapdog instead of a regulator. And I think that's a whole separate book for you guys after you write your PG&E book. And I just want to make a quick reference. I don't know if you're familiar with David K. Johnston. He won a Pulitzer at the New York Times. He's an independent writer now. And he is the first person who ever explained to me in plain English the term stranded costs. And that relates to PG&E trying to recapture the losses from the cost overruns at Diablo Canyon. And the book I interviewed him about, and this goes back a few years, is called The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. PG&E, hand in hand with the toothless regulatory agency, the PUC, has done quite a number on California. And Alistair, you referenced that there is a move, and it's one that I have tried to support and advocate for a public ownership option of PG&E. And the day before they emerged from bankruptcy last month, Governor Newsom signed a new law which does set the stage for a public takeover of PG&E if this current round of restructuring leads to the same level of failure. And I fundamentally support that because the shareholders and the ratepayers are largely the same group of people, not entirely, but I just think the taxpayers and the ratepayers are nearly identical, and that it would make more sense for the state to at least take ownership and hire operators to manage the company who would be more responsive to the safety mission, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, I think of what the people of Paradise make of what's going on with all this. I mean, they're obviously embroiled in their own battle with PG&E. They're working to get compensation from the company, which was finally agreed earlier this year. And for them, we've had several conversations with the people you profile in the book. And, you know, it's interesting the journey they've gone on with PG&E. Right after the fire, their take on PG&E was, we need this company to get power back on in our town. It's not a moment to point fingers. But we've seen, as the months have passed and as the magnitude of their losses have become apparent, the desire for compensation, the desire for there to be some kind of public reckoning has really just increased. An interesting detail we mentioned in the book, actually, is that the judge that's overseeing PG&E, its corporate probation, which stemmed from the San Bruno explosion, he actually ordered PG&E executives to take a tour of Paradise not long after the fire, and for them to really see the damage that they had done. And this tour took place without much public fanfare. But that was, it's a really striking moment for me, just imagining, and this judge accompanies them as well, imagining these executives looking at the town that their power line had devastated. And one hopes that it's moments like those where they come face to face with the destruction of the town, with their own linemen and women having lost their own homes as well in the fire. One hopes that that kind of thing as well will be a catalyst for change.
And you referred to Judge William Alsup, who I think has done a remarkable job in managing these very complex issues of assessing responsibility and then trying to come up with fair compensation. And Alistair, you just briefly referenced this, but give a little more detail, because you describe, I think it was a town meeting just 3 months after the fire, where a man was treated like a heckler and removed from the meeting because he pointedly asked a PG&E executive, just in plain English, did you cause this fire? And he was booed, and the city officials had the marshal or a cop remove him from the room. That was a stunning scene.
That was right after the fire. And I think in context, on the face of it, I agree, it does sound stunning. And the way we came to see it was, these were residents of a town that had just been destroyed. These people had just lost everything, and they were desperate for some sense of normality, for order to be restored. And, you know, I think that gentleman's question was completely fair. A PG&E executive was on stage, as you mentioned, talking about what happened, and this gentleman, this resident, stood up and said, hey, did you guys do it? Did you guys start the fire? And I think the reason that he was shushed was because at that moment, PG&E was playing an essential role. They needed PG&E to help get power back onto some of the few homes that had survived. PG&E was also involved in the cleanup operation. And so I don't think it's fair to say that the town was in some sense trying to cover up what PG&E had done. It was just that at that particular moment in time, they needed PG&E, and they needed also to have just some sense of order in their lives. And I think ultimately, as I mentioned, people are now demanding answers and have been demanding answers from PG&E, and there have been innumerable lawsuits against the company, many people making claims for compensation against the company. And PG&E actually agreed a substantial $several hundred million settlement with Butte County, Paradise, towns, other towns in the area affected by wildfire. And so I think we're seeing now that there is a kind of reckoning taking place.
We're talking with Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano. Their book is Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. It is a great read, and I highly recommend it on a number of levels, because for anyone who lives in a fire-prone zone, as we speak, there are serious wildfires in Arizona that are not getting adequate coverage in the mainstream media. Everything's focused on COVID right now. But the combination of COVID and trying to fight fires, producing evacuees who then have to risk infection if they end up in a shelter somewhere. I mean, these are complex and interwoven challenges that we face. And this book, I think, really in a way that is quite engaging because we meet so many of the victims, the heroes, and some of the survivors. And it really is a very well-written piece. Danny, let me ask you to take a couple of minutes here, if you would, to just thumbnail and introduce us to a small number, you choose, of the people who lived in Paradise and died in the firestorm on November 8th of 2018.
Sure. So one of the people that has just so come to represent Paradise and the Ridge as a whole to me is a man named John Sedgwick. At the time of the fire, he was an 82-year-old former volunteer firefighter. He lived in Magalia, which was just a mile or so up the road from Paradise. And he had lived in that area his whole life. His family moved there when he was a kid, when he was around 10. And he fell in love. He loved the trains. He loved the area's history. And that was where he wanted to call home. So he stayed in the area for decades. He worked as a museum docent. He worked as a logger for the Forest Service at one point. And at the time of the fire, he was actually still working, hadn't yet retired at a store down in Chico. And the day the fire started, John, who always, you know, closely monitored conditions because he knew that the area could face a bad fire, he woke up his daughter, who lived with him at the time and was about 50, and he told her, you know, I'm going to stay and keep an eye on things, but I think you should go. And the fact that he was telling his daughter to go, his daughter knew it was quite serious, and so she left and her father stayed. And he just spent the day making himself useful, you know, helping as much as he could. He helped neighbors save their homes. He saved these old historic buildings that had meant so much to him throughout his life. He helped some fire crews kind of map the fire because he knew these really confusing, kind of twisty, isolated roads that would have been quite difficult for large fire engines to navigate. And, you know, he fought it all day. And finally, that night, the fire burned over this historic building that was next to his house. It nearly trapped some firefighters, and they had to flee. And John passed that night. But his family, you know, takes real comfort in the fact that he fought so hard to save this area and to help his neighbors. And I think something about that really taps into the spirit of the area, both, you know, the desire to stay and give it your all and to help the people around you. And there are other stories like that, too. Another one that comes to mind is another parent and child. Victoria Taft lived with her daughter, Christina, and she was a really interesting person. A lot of interesting people came to settle in Paradise. She was a former actress and stunt woman who'd had this fascinating life in Hollywood before she had her daughter and settled in Paradise. And what happened that morning was that, you know, they got into an argument about the seriousness of things. Victoria, you know, was feeling like it wasn't that serious and she wouldn't have to leave. This is an area that had so many fires that people were used to the smell of smoke in the air. They were used to not necessarily having to evacuate just because there was something burning down the road. And what happened there was, you know, Christina chose to leave. Her mother didn't want to come, and her mother, unfortunately, passed away. And there are just so many countless stories like this. You know, and another one that comes to mind is a man named Julian Binstock. He was this famous, well, not famous, but he worked in Hollywood. I mean, he had this really fascinating life living all over the world and eventually chose to settle in Paradise with his wife. And he just really loved the area and loved living there. And after his wife passed, he stayed there with his dog and lived right along the canyon, which is this beautiful, beautiful ridge, and you can see the river flowing underneath it. He worked, as I said, in L.A. and also in, I believe, Japan and in Europe. So he just, I think, so encapsulates the interesting people that chose to settle there. And he's another one who was unfortunately lost in the fire with his dog there. So, you know, so many stories. I wish I could tell you all of them, of all of these 85, 86 people who passed there. But they're worth reading about and getting to know and seeing what the world lost that day.
Well, and this is where you and Alistair, I think, just did a brilliant job of bringing these colorful characters to life and also sharing, in many cases, their deaths. And, you know, like any small town in California, I've lived in a similar area in the Santa Cruz Mountains. There are these people who you would describe as very colorful. Some of them were, you know, engaged in an alternate lifestyle that was not a hippie lifestyle, but more of a redneck style, if we want to call it that. And I just think you really bring them to us in a way that is vibrant and honors their role in the town and their efforts on the day of the fire. And Alistair, if I could ask you similarly to thumbnail some of the heroes and the survivors of that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's three people. The first is Joe Kennedy, who is a Cal Fire firefighter, a bulldozer operator. And on the morning when tens of thousands of people were gridlocking the streets as they poured out of town to try and escape, Joe was one of the people going in the opposite directions. He drove his big truck, dragging his bulldozer, parked in front of the hospital in town, and got to work saving lives. And not only did he assist in creating fire breaks and creating containment lines, he also saved many, many lives. There was a fire truck that was trapped behind some burned out cars, and sitting in the cab of that fire truck were firefighters and several people who were trying to escape. It was so hot inside that cab, the paint was melting, the plastic was melting, the hubcaps were melting, but there was no way for them to get out. They were surrounded by burning cars. And so Joe Kennedy heard their distress call, and with his own windows cracking from the heat, it was hard for him to breathe. It was so hot, he cleared dozens of burned out cars or burning cars and enabled that fire truck to escape. So he's certainly one of the fire's heroes. Another person that I think of who is a survivor, but also, you know, he's a survivor, but unfortunately her partner wasn't, is a woman named Iris. And she had lived in the area for decades, knew fires, knew that the area was susceptible to fires. She had even bought a car for her disabled husband to be able to escape in, hopefully, if she was away. And on the morning of the fire, she was away. She was working in Santa Rosa in wine country, and she was on the phone with her partner, Andrew, many times that morning, over 3 or 4 hours, between when they heard the fire had started and when they last had contact. She was urging him to escape. And unfortunately, he was unable to. And so Iris was a survivor, but, you know, her life had been destroyed. And I spent a lot of time with Iris, and she's just this incredible, resilient person. And what's wonderful about Iris is that she has remained really committed to the town and now has brought in lots of local artisans to work at, to work through the store she works at in Paradise. She sells things at an antique store and make lots of items that are branded Paradise Made. And so she's really trying to, through her own loss, despite her own loss, she's really trying to bring attention back to the town and help revive the town. And then the final person I think of is a gentleman who, well, he was behind the fire on the day of the fire. He was, sorry, I'm just thinking to myself, actually, is this the best story to tell you about? Because it's quite long.
No, I've got time. It's a podcast.
yeah, I'm just trying to think of the best person to tell you about, my third person. Well, I'll tell you about one final incredible escape. This was a family who lived by a lakeside, just a couple miles east of Paradise. Their name was Scott and Renee Carlin. They had several children. The morning of the fire, Scott, who was a former firefighter, he heard about the fire over the radio that he kept in just over his shoulder. He kept an emergency scanner just because he'd been a firefighter himself, and he loved to stay connected to that world. So he got his family up, and they were rushing towards the road that they were planning to escape on when they heard over that scanner, as they were throwing their stuff into the suitcases, that that road had become blocked. And so Scott thought of the one place that he knew that would be free of fire, and it was indeed that lake that they lived on. And this was a large lake. It was freezing. It was November. And so they got towards the lakeside, and the fire chased them to the lakeside. They edged out into the reeds. But the reeds themselves started catching fire. And so the family got into the lake, and they swam into the lake to escape the fire. Down the lake shore, they discovered some boats that they quickly got into. They piled all their stuff into. They piled their pets into. And they actually paddled to the other side of the lake to escape the fire. And that was where some of their neighbors found them, and they were able to escape. And so Scott and Renee Carlin and their family, it's another incredible story of escape that always just, gladdens my heart in a way to think of what they were able to do and how they were able to get out of the way. And remarkably, their house also survived.
And you depict so many other people. And on the one hand, we see great human resourcefulness in a very dire situation. We also see the way people who might not have shared the same politics or interests put all that aside to help each other in a truly dire situation. And I want to ask, about 9 days into this experience, and the fire did go on for weeks and only was extinguished when the rains started to come. But the Stable Genius helicoptered in from Washington and he prescribed that California needed to rake the forests more frequently, and that was the lesson to be learned from this. And, of course, it's absurd, and it betrays ignorance of the factors of wildfires and the situation on the ground. But how did the people of Paradise respond when Trump came in with this kind of off-base lecture? Danny, you want to take that?
Sure. I think they were really upset, and Paradise was an area that was more conservative, more Republican, where I think the president did have a lot of support. But the fact that he, had started tweeting about what happened and condemning California and kind of taking this tone, this scolding tone, was upsetting to people that he did that before even offering condolences.
Well, it was a threatening tone. He was saying billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forest. Remedy now or no more Fed payments. I mean, that's the brilliance of a guy who's lived in condos his whole life.
Yeah, and it really rubbed people the wrong way. I remember hearing when I was at one of these community meetings while the fire was still happening in the early days, I remember hearing a man approach the local congressman and he said, I like Trump, but I didn't like when he did that. That really hurt me. And that was just something I heard time and time again. And so by the time the president arrived in the area for a visit, I was down at the Walmart, which became this kind of refugee camp where evacuees just flocked to immediately following the fire, first to meet their loved ones, but then it became a place where, people were bringing donations and bringing food, and people who had nowhere else to go were sleeping outside in tents and in sleeping bags. And I talked to quite a few people there, and there wasn't the relief that I might have expected to hear that the president was coming to the area. There was just a lot of hurt and anger, people saying, I voted for that man, and now I don't care about him. I don't like him. And so I think when people were so wounded and so hurt, they'd lost everything. They'd lost their friends. Some of them had lost family. They'd lost their homes and their town. to hear that was just a slap in the face.
Yeah. And Alistair, as we get ready to wrap up here, a slightly lighter question for you. I feel like the way there is this regimen for naming hurricanes, that we need to come up with protocols for naming wildfires, because this one is technically called the Camp Fire. And it leads many people to believe that it was campers who, you know, were making coffee or frying up some grits who caused this fire. And likely, similarly, the car fire going back a couple of years actually has two R's in it. But people think, oh, it started when a car blew up. So do you find that the way the names are assigned is often confusing to people?
Well, you're right with the campfire. People often assume that it is, in fact, the campfire that started it, a wayward camper, perhaps. That the fire actually started in a very deep ravine a couple miles east of Paradise, and it started off a dirt road that was called Camp Creek Road. And so that's the naming standard, is that they often take names based on a nearby geographical feature or a road or something like that. So I think you're right. I think they do often lead to confusion and, at least to some very, very colorful names. I think of the Atlas Fire, the Honey Fire. They're quite evocative in a way. But, yeah, they can potentially be misleading as to their origins. You're right.
Now, after this fire, did you pick up any of the hysterical conspiracy theories on social media? I actually did a podcast debunking claims that came from armchair experts on Facebook thousands of miles away, who said, oh, this was a some sort of a high-tech weapon that had been tested. There are other people who blame it on the United Nations. and it was, because I'm a person who actually explores some so-called conspiracy theories. I call them cover-ups, and I'm trying to look for the real story. But we saw these incredible crackpot ideas about how, they believe the fire started. And it's always these, dark ideas about humans who wanted this carnage to occur. Did that come onto your radar, Danny, as you were researching the book?
Absolutely. From the beginning, it was on my radar, just from some of the local community groups that I'm a part of on social media. I saw that come up. And on one hand, it's supremely frustrating because, we have a very clear idea of what caused this fire. And, thinking of the people I know there, there's something about it. It's really frustrating when you have friends and family who have lost homes and to see people throw out such misinformation about it being, laser beams or whatnot. But gradually, the way I've come to think of it is that whenever bad things happen, whenever things that just defy imagination that are so awful, whether it is, a devastating fire that kills dozens and wipes out a town, or whether it's, an act of violence, I think these conspiracy theories pop up, in my opinion, because it's a way to kind of explain the world a little bit. I think it's easier for people to think that there is someone out there with malicious intent rather than that the world is unpredictable. And the things we love and the places we love can be destroyed and taken away at a moment's notice.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today. I want to recommend your book, Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. We've been talking with reporters for The Guardian newspaper, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano. And just in closing, I want to tell you that I go to The Guardian U.S. website every day, and I hope you'll share with the American editorial team that I think as a group you do incredible enterprise reporting that puts the American-based newspapers that still have a print edition. The Guardian is completely online now. And just last week, the series exposing the high cost of water that people in communities across the country pay, that is something that I don't see in the mainstream media in this country. And so and a few years back, it was Spencer Ackerman who exposed the Chicago Police Department's Homan Square office where they were doing illegal things with suspects. And once again, that was a story that really was barely touched by even the Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times, who owe it to their local readers. So I don't know how big the staff is in the United States, but you're doing some really strong reporting, and I just want you to know that readers like me appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. We are part of the U.S. editorial team, and you know, we do strive to just look at some of the fundamentals in life: inequality, justice, food, water, energy, access to fair policing. We just prioritize those fundamentals and try to look at it from that perspective. And so I'm really glad that that's coming through to readers like you.
Danny, you want to comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, thank you. We so appreciate it. I think that's one of the wonderful things about working for The Guardian is being around journalists who care so much about the work they do and telling these stories that are often ignored.
Well, very well. Thank you both. Pleasure meeting you, and I wish you the best, and I hope people will go out and pick up your book and read it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.